Welcome to another exciting episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the Brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The Brothers Anderson are... This is Eric.
It is better to be truthful and good than to not.
This is Brother Jay.
You ask me if I have a God complex? Let me tell you something. I am God.
This is true.
There is a storm coming like nothing you have ever seen, and not a one of you is prepared for it.
And they are sometimes joined by guests like...
This is Travis.
I had to stop her from screaming.
And Diane.
If you men only knew.
So sit back, close your eyes, and let us take you away. Unless you're driving, in which case keep your eyes open and watch the road and, you know, anyway. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is Brother Jay.
And tonight, we're going to talk about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home. 1986, directed by Leonard Nimoy. This is the last of the Nimoy-directed Star Treks. And this movie was dedicated to the astronauts aboard the Challenger when they had their fatal accident. Where were you?
Yeah, that was... When was Challenger?
It was 85. Maybe actually early 86.
I don't think... So 86, what time of... It was 11:30 in the morning. No, it was 11:30 Eastern time. So 11... 86, I would have still been in Alaska. So 86, I would have been how old? Let's see, I would have been...
Oh, yeah, I was still at school. I mean, I think I was at the school library at service.
I'm trying to think what grade 86 would have been, so...
I was in 10th grade, so you would have been in...
6th grade.
Yeah, 6th or 7th.
6th or 7th. I think I was in 7th grade. I think I was in... I want to say I was in English class. Yeah, I would have either been on my way to school or in my first hour class. Because it was on... It was on a weekday, I'm pretty sure.
Did they bring a TV in, or did they tell you, or do you remember it at all?
Yeah, I think, if I remember correctly, I think I was first period English class, and I think they rolled the TV in, and I think they made an announcement over the overhead, and so I think there, and there was, nobody quite knew what had happened, because it was the day before everything was, you know, instantly televised, and, you know, Alaska being the kind of the backwood that it was, we didn't get live TV a lot. And so I think I remember like when Reagan was shot, they wheeled TVs into, I was still in Rabbit Creek Elementary, but when Reagan was shot, they rolled TVs in. But I remember them rolling TVs in and them kind of talking about it. And we kind of, I think we stayed in our first period class for the first three periods. And then, cause they wanted to, you know, talk about what it was going on. And so it was just kind of this weird kind of, you know, being in that kind of that middle school, experience where, you know, seventh grade, you know, where you're old enough to kind of understand that there was death, but you're not quite old enough to understand, you know, the complexity of everything that happened. So I think I was just, it was very kind of abstract because I wasn't directly involved. And it wasn't until my sophomore year in high school where it became a much bigger deal because my high school chemistry teacher, Mrs. Heinrich, who is probably one of my most favorite teachers ever, she was the backup for Krista McCullough.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is the teacher in space, the first teacher in space.
Yeah, and so I guess she was Krista McCullough's either second or third backup. She didn't talk about it very much and very clearly, I think, because it very much upset her. But I get the impression that she had been on site the morning that the shuttle exploded, and so it affected her deeply. So any time there was a shuttle launch when we were in high school, when Mrs. Heinrich was around, like, she would have a TV in her room all day long, and that's all we would do was we would watch the TV because she was interested in it. And she would talk about it. I mean, she would make us talk about work. Also, I had to propose a NASA shuttle project in her class. All of us did. So we all had to write a proposal of a project to be submitted to be put up on the space shuttle.
Sweet.
Yeah, it was a very strange kind of, it was just strange. I remember it being a tragedy, and I actually read the presidential report, the investigation, on the accident, which was actually it was a pretty large congressional report. I checked it out from the library, and I think Mom thought I was crazy. But I read a lot of stuff like that. I really liked to read stuff like that because it was really technical and in depth. Having read through that, it was kind of enlightening. But at the time, it was just, it was something terrible that had happened, but I wasn't fully aware and engaged because I really didn't have much, in the space program. I'd never thought I would be an astronaut. I never thought I would be involved. So, it didn't impact me directly. I think the first real time was, I think it was Discovery, when Discovery came through the atmosphere and disintegrated. I think that actually affected me much, much worse.
Wait. This is just to be clear, even though the background noise, this is not the Star Trek episode with horses.
No. It's my dog freaking out from coming back inside.
We went out to try a playground today, but unfortunately it was like 41 degrees and there was still snow on some of the playground, but at the bottom of the slides it was just this like puddles of water. Very cold water.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, so we decided against it.
Not big piles of mud.
No, because everything was still fairly frozen. The ground was.
No.
Yeah, very little snow on the ground, but the ground was frozen. For the most part, there was standing water several places, but standing on top of frozen ground. So.
On frozen ground.
Anyway, okay.
I think that's a movie.
I think so. I think it's The Frozen Ground, isn't it? Or no, it's just Frozen Ground.
I don't know.
On Golden Pond.
I was playing that with On Deadly Ground, which is that horrible...
Oh, Steven Seagal.
Exactly.
I think so. It's a three-word title. It's got to be Steven Seagal.
Yeah, because it was originally... I think we already had this discussion. It was originally titled like something else, like Alaska Warrior or something stupid.
Yeah, I don't remember. Was that Rainbow Warrior?
I think it was Rainbow Warrior.
The one filmed in Alaska?
Yeah.
Where he stayed at my hotel, and I got to talk to Kelly LeBrock. Don't hate her because she's beautiful. But only over the phone, so.
I don't have anything against Kelly LeBrock, and I don't have anything directly against Steven Seagal, but he's kind of a douchebag, so.
Yeah, his people were douchebags. I remember that.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad to know that it wasn't just my interpretation. Well, my interpretation and the interpretation, of course, of a late radio program that I used to listen to daily. Hi, Barry. You'll remember this. Steven Seagal. Apparently, they had an interview, a phone interview with him, and it was like they called and woke him up.
Too funny.
And so his answers like, he was like, yeah. This is like very like low, like barely conscious, and his answers were like almost non-existent.
Excellent. Well, I listened to the Sklarbro County, and Daniel Van Kirk does his Steven Seagal impression and calls in, and it's very funny.
Oh?
Yeah, he's always like homeless. but anyway. Yeah. So,
acclaimed musician, Steven Seagal.
Well... There's different kinds of acclaim.
Yeah, in your own mind.
Yeah. Okay, so before we dive back into the movie, have you listened to the other podcasts?
Yeah, I have, except for, I didn't, the one that came up, which one was it?
The American.
I haven't listened to that one yet.
Okay, I was going to ask, we actually take a 10-minute tangent in that one.
Oh, well, I kind of like the tangent.
Oh, no, me too.
It makes me feel better about It makes me feel better about my tangentism.
Oh, no. That's the tangents are the best part. But literally, I had to go back and figure out how long it really was, because I thought, oh, wow, this is a gigantic tangent. But fun. Don't get me wrong. I left it in. But
the movie before that one, Domino.
Yes. Have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't seen it. And I don't know that I will, although it's fascinating to listen to you and Drew talk about it, because Drew really liked it, and Drew didn't like it, and you did, right?
Correct.
I was thinking, see, I was swapping that with Miami Vice, where Drew loved it and you were like, not so much.
Yeah. And Drew didn't hate it, and I didn't think it was the best movie ever made. I just had a lot of fun, and Drew didn't.
Yeah. Yeah. No, so, but it was funny. I thought it was funny because you were talking about, like, there's one part of the movie that like went on for 10 minutes. And I think you later at one point said, it only went on for like a minute and a half.
Oh, I played the entire part. I mean, yeah. It was like, actually, I think it was, I don't think I quite played the entire part, but it was under 3 minutes long.
It's pretty funny. No, but it tells you that we, you know, relativity exists. You know, we all bring that to the table because, you know, upon rewatching movies, sometimes they seem longer on the rewatch than the first time because, you know, I'm already aware of what's coming. And then for some reason, I think it's going to be faster than it is.
Well, yeah,
because I don't know why our brains trick ourselves into that, but at least mine does.
Well, sometimes, like, you're on the edge of your seat. You know, and that's the one thing about, not the one thing, that's a thing I have learned in a year of podcasting about movies, is that I don't think I watch movies a lot differently than I did before, but I pay attention to a lot of different things, and one of them is definitely pacing. If the movie is not well paced, it's got a huge problem to overcome.
The pace can very much tell you sometimes that a movie is written in parts, as is this movie was written in four different parts, if you didn't know.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So having that, I have the entire Star Trek series movies on Blu-ray in a set. It came in a set. So I have all of them. And as the impetus to get the schmoes like me to go and pay the however ungodly amounts of money I spent. Granted, I actually didn't buy this new. I bought it new from Amazon, but I didn't buy it when it came out. I bought it, you know, years and years after.
Yeah. Today you could buy it at Best Buy for $60.
I actually don't think I paid that much for it. I think I got it on like an Amazon special for like $45.
Yeah. Well, that's a good price.
Yeah. No, it's like, and it's got extra stuff, and it's got actually an entire separate Blu-ray DVD of extra stuff on top of all the DVDs that already have extra stuff. And like last night, I spent 2.5 hours in the extra stuff. So I spent more time in the extra stuff than I did in the movie.
Oh, well, so let's not that. Let's just cut partly to the chase as far as how do you think this ranks?
In 1 through 4 so far or in totality?
Well, I guess all we can rank is 1 through 4 so far.
I think it was. You know what? It's hard to rank it because I still think Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, I think, was the best so far. I have a hard time comparing which one's better, this one or Star Trek III.
Okay, let me change the parameters of the question.
Sure.
Which is the most fun of the four movies?
Oh, this is more fun.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun at this movie. William Shatner will never win an Oscar for his acting. But he is a very capable, broad comic actor. Like, he does some really fun stuff in this movie.
Yeah, if they had made, and this movie was not much science fiction, and you're right, this really had kind of some slapstick element to it.
Oh, a lot of slapstick element. But, we'll get into it, but it wasn't just a lot of one-off, like one-liners. It was a progression of jokes that worked really well.
But there was a lot of good one-liners, too.
Oh, yeah. No, lots of quotable stuff. But simply the Spock swearing lasted for one beat longer than you expected, and that was all you needed to make it perfect.
And it was still funny.
It was funny every time. And, you know, one beat longer than you expected. It was great. But everybody was giving really good performances, even in the background.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times where James Doohan and DeForest Kelly were just kind of in the background working on building the tank or whatever. And where Kirk and Spock or whoever have the foreground and have all the action, they're still acting in the background. And it's really fun. I mean, it really shows off their professionalism.
And in this movie, Kearney got a pretty big, substantial part in this.
Oh, yeah.
Including his own theme.
I'm sorry, who got their own theme?
Chekhov.
I didn't recognize that he had his own theme, but that's funny.
Yeah. The part where he's running across the deck is a kind of this Russian dirge.
Oh, that's so. Does it come up later?
I don't think so. But they wrote that specifically. It's just his theme. Well, that's kind of his theme for the movie.
That's great. So shall we dive into the movie, or do we want to dive into the background?
Well, we can dive into the background if you want. There's a lot of background. So they're calling this the Accidental Trilogy. So Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 are actually a trilogy.
And I can see that, because in this movie, there's even no Enterprise until the very end.
Right. And there's some things about it that are kind of interesting. Harv Bennett said when they were filming Star Trek 2, they were already writing Star Trek 3. And when they were filming Star Trek 3, they were already writing Star Trek 4. And so the reason that the movies flow together as they do is because they knew that they were going to have a continuity, and they wanted that. So that's kind of why, you know, Star Trek 3 starts where Star Trek 2 ended, and Star Trek 4 starts where Star Trek 3 ended. If you watch them all in a row, they could be one big long movie, except the clothes change. I mean, the uniforms obviously change, because the uniforms again were different in this one. So Harv's theory was, you know, act one, you throw rocks at your characters. Act two, you run them up a tree. In act three, you bring them back. And that's what he says Star Trek 2, 3, and 4 is.
Well, and you have to tie it up. And they tied everything up nicely. If this had been the last movie of this cast, it would have been fine.
Yeah.
I mean, not that we wouldn't want to see them again, but at least everybody got to the end of it in a way that's believable.
And there's some things in it that, I'll mention it when we get there. I don't want to spoil it. So okay. let's jump into the movie.
Okay. So after the dedication of the Challenger astronauts, we have the old theme song and the transporter sound. And then what I thought was a really galloping orchestral score. Like it was
very symphonic,
very big. And it had lots of like piccolos and stuff.
Chime bells.
Lots of like little runs from different instruments in the orchestra, which I thought was really fun and interesting.
Yeah, but then, and here's my problem. So here's my problem with the movie opening. It was symphonic and it was great. And I love all that. And then it opens to the giant space turd.
Yes, which is true. It's the year 2086. Sorry, it's the year 2286. And a large cylindrical probe moves through space, sending out an indecipherable signal and disabling the power of ships it passes. So yeah, it is kind of a space turd. Luckily, there wasn't a lot of turd porn. You know, they had to do the effect where they show the scope of it, but there weren't lots of lingering shots, except of that little rotating soccer ball thing.
Yeah. I don't know if it's supposed to be like brain or soccer ball.
Yeah, I couldn't tell. At first, I thought it was supposed to be like planet or soccer ball. But
yeah, throughout the movie, you know, one of the things is that the probe is making noise, and the studio said, we want, this is so ridiculous too, saying it out loud, it just makes me laugh. The studio demanded that they put subtitles in for what the probe was saying.
Which is ridiculous.
And Lenny, you know, Leonard Nimoy and Harv Bennett and one of the other writers were like, absolutely not. Absolutely not. There doesn't need to be any subtitles. And the reason being, you know, it's the romance of the film and the mystery of the film and the imagination of the film. And it puts that completely into the audience's brain, and the audience can take with it whatever they want to. And so it's a multi-dimensional message where, you know, some people are going to take it as this is, you know, Greenpeace, and some people are going to take it as, you know, politics, or some people are just going to go home and think about it. But we're not giving them anything, you know, to put in their heads other than the imagery. They can take the rest of the meaning on their own.
Well, or like me, it's the giant cylindrical MacGuffin. It doesn't matter. It's just getting us into the story.
Right.
You know, there's no need to explain it any further, because it's just a vehicle to get them where they're going.
Right.
So, but it is a powerful little probe. By the way, this series is probe heavy, And I don't remember. I mean, I know there are instances of probes in the original series, and I'm sure there were probe type objects in Next Generation. But let me tell you, this series of movies is right now we have half of the movies involve big probes.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, I would submit technically more than half of the movies, because the Genesis device is kind of just a probe.
Well, kind of. I mean, it's sort of, yeah, it's more than a probe, but yeah, you're right. So we see the captain of the Saratoga, who is a nice black lady. She's the first female captain of any kind in the Federation that we know of. We also later see the captain of the Yorktown, who is an Indian guy, subcontinent, not Native American. So we already have people of color being, you know, captains of other ships, which from 1986.
Life's Pageant. It's a very diverse movie.
Yeah. But we cut to what I presume is Earth. Maybe not. Maybe it's some space station where the Klingon ambassador is asking for Admiral Kirk's extradition as basically a war criminal.
No, that was Earth. That was the headquarters, because later on Sarek is trapped there still.
Oh, that's right. Okay. But the Klingon guy isn't trapped there.
Well, no, they all left before, so.
But the Klingon guy is pretty ominous as far as saying there will be no peace as long as Kirk lives. So Kirk is a problem for the Klingons. And then back on planet Vulcan, the former officers of the Enterprise are living in exile for at least the last couple of months. And they have rechristened the Klingon ship the HMS Bounty.
Which is funny.
It is.
But it's interesting that they were tried, you know, their court-martial was in absentia.
Well, it wasn't, though, was it? They weren't
present for the court.
Yeah, they were at the end. It was one.
No, but they weren't there for the. They weren't there for any of the hearing.
Well, I suppose. Well, no, I guess they faced criminal charges, but it ended up being an administrative punishment, much to the annoyance of the Klingons, who they killed the Klingon crew and stole a ship.
Yeah, even though the whole Reliant kaboom.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, the Klingons acted first, and you know, that's again.
Han shot first.
Yeah. Exactly. So, back on the planet Vulcan, we have Spock, who's retraining his brain, and he is confounded during a mental retraining test with the question, how do you feel? And then we get this nice scene with Spock and his mom. And this is Jane Wyatt.
Yep.
In her last movie role, and she does great. And, you know, Nimoy does a great job. As I think this is his best portrayal of Spock in the movies, at least so far.
And of course, he's going back to old school, like, you know, hard ass, rigid Spock.
But not quite so distant as in the other movies.
Well, no, he's reconnected as Katra.
Well, of course. And anyway, so the Saratoga is crippled by this probe. And they say back on Earth that another Starfleet starship has been neutralized. That's the Yorktown. And some other Klingon craft have been destroyed or disabled. And some other, like, freight vehicles for the Starfleet have been neutralized. But the crew of the Bounty are returning to face their punishment, going back to Earth, riding in the enemy spacecraft. It seems like, you know, they could have just sent a ship to pick them up. Although it turns out there's not a ton of ships, because there are a lot of ships in port when this probe hits.
Well, it's a space dock, so yeah.
Yeah, well, so they're returning to Earth, except for Savik, who remains on Vulcan. And why does Savik remain on Vulcan?
Would you like to know why?
Please tell us.
So they were writing, again, this was a case where they were actually writing for anticipation of another movie. And so this was plot foundation that they were going to realize later on, but it was cut from the film. So the reason that Savik is there is because she's pregnant with Spock's child.
Well, they're ponfaring.
Yeah, so that's why she's there with Spock's mother, is because they're talking about the baby.
Yeah, so she gets a nice little one scene, but then we're done with Savik because we're going.
Yeah, but. But I realize, of course, the scene was probably edited, which is why it looks the way it does. But it's like, you know, I just wanted to say, you know, I just wanted to talk about David. And like, now, bitch, like, now you talk about David? Like, you choose the day they're leaving, like, the last minute to just like, oh, by the way, I know that it was the only way they could squeeze it into the plot, but it was like, really, like, not really. It took me out of the movie. Like, you've been on the planet with them all this time, and like, you take the last minute to say, you know, your son was a hero.
Well, and the one thing you can't criticize Kirk about is being unavailable to his female crewmates.
That's like, absolutely true.
Like, you'd think in 3 months he could spare a couple minutes to talk to Savick.
Oh, he would spare a couple minutes.
Oh, yeah. She wouldn't necessarily. But yeah, you're right.
No.
Yeah, it doesn't. Why wait till the very end? Then again, yeah, she's all...
the inevitable dramatic tension and plot.
But... anyway, so they head from Vulcan to Earth, and the probe has made it to Earth and starts disabling all the power grid. It disables the space dock so no vessels can launch from it, and it generates these planetary storms, which creates this sun-blocking cloud cover, and Starfleet is forced to send out a planetary distress call to warn everybody to stay away from Earth.
And I don't know if you noticed here one of the cameos.
I didn't notice, but I was happy to read about it.
About Christine Chapel, Major Barrett?
No, not that one. But yeah, go ahead.
Oh, so because Commander Christine Chapel.
Excellent.
Who was Christine Chapel? She was, you know, the doctor on the original Star Trek.
Yeah, Nurse Chapel.
On the original,
right?
Enterprise, Nurse Chapel. So she went to Commander Chapel as part of Starfleet. And, of course, she was Major Barrett, who was Gene Roddenberry's wife. Also, she's the voice of the computer, many of the female voices of the Enterprise computers, as well as Loxana Troi in The Next Generation.
Did you notice the other cameo just before they sent out the planetary distress signal? This is via a viewer screen. At Starfleet headquarters?
I'm not sure. I don't think so.
Jane Whalen?
Was that her?
Yes.
No. I didn't know it was her. From the Go-Go's, right?
Yeah, and also the Telegram girl.
From Clue.
Yes. Pretty great there.
Yeah, there's lots of little Easter eggs like that.
Yeah. So they hear Starfleet's warning, and the bounty crew is trying to figure out what's going on. So Spock determines that the probe signal matches a song of humpback whales, which are extinct, and that because they're extinct, there will be no answer to the call. And even if they could replicate the sound of humpback whales, there wouldn't be, it would just be gibberish.
Right.
So what's the solution they come up with? Our favorite trope in Not in a Creepy Way's first year. Time travel.
This is something I don't understand, because I never understood like how does slingshotting into the sun make time travel possible? That's the device that's never been explained to me.
Yeah, you can't go backwards in time.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That's the whole problem with time travel. Yeah. But yeah, so we're just gonna take this just like the probe, where it's gonna be the time travel MacGuffin.
There are four parts of this movie. They're written in four parts, and so Act 1 and Act 4 were written by Harve Bennett, and Act 2 and 3 are written by, I've forgotten his name already. The space stuff was written by Harve Bennett, and the middle stuff, the Earth stuff, was written by another team.
Which makes sense, because the shenanigans that happen in Earth aren't really, I mean, except for the fact that they have a couple of boxes to check off, if you pardon that pun.
Ha ha.
Then they just can't get back to the space pod. So whatever you want to throw in there in between the check-offing of boxes. I'm doing my best.
I'm laughing. I mean, I'm laughing, so don't worry about it.
Oh, you're laughing. Yeah. Anyway, so yes, comedy is not one of our hallmarks necessarily. So their plan is, and it is a silly plan, is to go back and grab some whales and then come back. And even Bones isn't too happy about this plan.
Scotty, how long is this bay?
About 60 feet, Admiral.
Can you enclose it to hold water?
I suppose I could. You're planning to take a swim?
Off to the deep end, Mr. Scott.
We gotta find some humpbacks.
Humpbacked people?
Whales, Mr. Scott, whales. About 45 to 50 feet long. About 40 tons each.
You're really going to try time travel in this rust bucket?
We've done it before.
Sure, slingshot around the sun. Pick up enough speed, you're in time warp. If you don't, you're fried.
Would you prefer to do nothing?
I prefer a dose of common sense. You're proposing that we go backwards in time, find humpback whales, then bring them forward in time, drop them off, and hope to hell they tell this probe what to go do with itself.
That's the general idea.
Well, that's crazy.
You got a better idea? Now's the time.
So they travel back in time to the year 1986. And here's where the fun part of this movie starts, because it really gets cracking immediately. They arrive in Golden Gate Park, they use the cloaking device, and then they have to split up to accomplish some tasks. But before they split up, they are crossing a street in San Francisco, and a cab driver screeches to avoid hitting him and says, and calls Kirk a dumbass.
Dumbass on you!
Which is the beginning of how much fun this movie is going to be. Because Spock is curious about the language, and Kirk just says, no, you have to use lots of cursing and swearing. Otherwise, people don't pay attention to you. So then they have to get some money. So Kirk sells his reading glasses for $100, which they split up. You know, don't go crazy.
Yeah, with the $7 they'll get or whatever.
Exactly. So Kirk and Spock have to go find some whales. And there's a lot of fun shenanigans because, of course, Spock is dressed in his robe with his piece of his robe that he ripped off around his head to cover his Vulcan ears. And Kirk is in his maroon and pink uniform. And they get on a bus and they go to the Sausalito Museum. At the Cetacean Center. The Cetacean Institute. But the bus scene. Isn't the bus scene, like, the best?
So the bus scene is hilarious. And the boombox guy is one of the sound guys from the movie. And he wrote the punk song. But they overproduced it, and it sounded too good. So they actually went into the hallway of the studio and recorded it in the hallway.
Which is fantastic.
It's pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah. And I guess Nimoy came up with the neck pinch scene when he had some sort of similar experience with the person with a big ghetto blaster radio. And he thought to himself, if I really was a Vulcan, I'd just pinch the crap out of him.
Yeah. But the turning off of the boombox with the guy's face was the sound guy's choice.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, I think the sound guy, didn't he like campaign for the role? Like he bought his own clothes and stuff?
Oh, I don't know, probably.
I think so. I think he actually really pitched himself, which is great. And then there's the scene where Uhura and Chekhov are asking where the nuclear vessels are. And did you hear the story of the only person who talked to them? The cop didn't talk to them. The other people who were passing by didn't talk to them. But the one girl stops and like says three words or something. Yeah, and she was in the movie because she had her car towed because of the movie filming. So when they discovered that her car was towed, they offered her the extra work to basically pay for getting her car out of impound. And she wasn't supposed to speak to anybody because a speaking role requires more payment. But she spoke and they liked it. So she had to sign a bunch of extra paperwork. And even though she wasn't credited in the film itself, she's definitely credited in IMDb.
Well, because Harv Bennett had told all the extras, ignore them, completely ignore them. But he didn't tell the actors that he had told the extras to ignore them.
Which is great. So their befuddlement
they're legitimately trying to get people to talk to them. You know, like, you know, they had stage directions. And of course, you know, like everybody's like, nope, I'm not talking to you, crazy people.
So then they get to the Cetacean Institute, and they meet Dr. Gillian Taylor, played by Catherine Hicks. And her connection is she's the mom in Seventh Heaven, Stephen Collins' wife.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And did you see the thing I put on Facebook?
That I did with the Jill Eikenberry?
Yes. Yes. I swear, I was like, oh my God, L.A. Law Girl is in the Star Trek movie. But no, they just look exactly the same.
And there were two actresses up for the role of that part. And Harp Bennett said, you know, we got her on set with Bill Shatner. And like they hit it off, and so he knew that she was it. But then, like, nowhere I could find no mention of who the other actress was.
At least the commonly held belief was that in the first version of the script, it wasn't going to be the cetacean expert, whatever. Instead, it was going to be a professor who specialized in whale song, and they had an actor in mind who was a really big Star Trek fan, and that actor was
Eddie Murphy.
Yes.
And I hope you laughed at the text message I sent you. I said, Kirk, you know, effing a black man would be pretty progressive. And you said, well, there would have been a fair amount of rewriting. And I said, you think Kirk, interracial, bisexual captain, showing that love transcends time, space, race, and gender.
Very, very progressive.
So instead, they just got this chick to do both parts. And then I made the quip that I bet they paid her for playing both parts, just perhaps 85%.
Yes, of one of the parts. First of all, Paramount, I guess, wasn't super thrilled. But also, Eddie Murphy didn't want to be the professor. He wanted to either be an alien or he wanted to be a member of Starfleet. And so when they couldn't hash that out, he just said, okay, I'm going to do Golden Child instead.
Well, which was probably a better choice. Because had he been in this movie, I think it would have ended up very different. It would have been like Lampoon's Vacation kind of different.
Well, and yeah, I mean, these guys are actors who were given some funny roles, and he is a comedian who would be acting. And I think that would have upset the balance.
Yeah, I think it would have really changed the movie writing and the dynamic, because I suspect he would have wanted and pushed for a much more comedic script.
Well, and he would have, I mean, the reason Beverly Hills Cop works so well is he was the funny guy and everybody else were the straight men. But right now, we've got lots of little funny parts in this. So I don't think the contrast would have held up very well.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, who knows? You know, I mean, again, is woulda, coulda, shoulda. But I think the funniest moment, and I remember laughing in the theater at this, and it's played so well by William Shatner. I mean, I cannot give him enough credit for this, that when they're taking the tour at the Cetacean Center, and they're with this tour group, and they're listening very careful to Dr. Julian's tour speech, and all of a sudden, you notice Spock swimming into the pool with the whales. And doing the mind meld. And Kirk is just sort of having the cow, but trying to be very cool about it. It's so funny. I mean, it's played so perfectly.
He really did a good job he really does have some acting ability. I think he does faux surprise well.
He does. And he's very charismatic.
It's a slapstick panic that he does well, I think.
Yeah.
Which sometimes I think he does slapstick panic when it's not really meant to be slapstick. It's just meant to be panic.
Yeah, he does like the slapstick version of true drama also.
I love William Shatner. I mean, a lot of people think he's a dick. And I'm like, I think if you listen, because watching all the special features, he's just a dick. But I think that's an act. I think it's intentional to try and be funny. But I think people don't get that he's trying to be funny.
Well,
it comes off across as his being a colossal prick, but I don't think you were with me when I saw Henry Rollins, and Henry Rollins talked about his experience with William Shatner. Apparently, they're friends, they're pals, Shatner and Rollins, which is inexplicable, but okay.
Well, no, they met at the Ben Folds taping, right?
I have no idea. Oh, yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah, Ben Folds did that album. He had both Rollins and William Shatner, and that led to William Shatner doing his own album.
Well, and that's where Rollins and Shatner doing the, you know, I can't get behind that.
My favorite shows on TV have 12 minutes of advertising.
I can't get behind that kind of time.
Eat quickly, drive faster, make more money now. I can't get behind that.
My kids say, he said to me, and I'm like, and he's like, and she's like,
it's all he's all, she's all.
I can't get behind that kind of, like, English.
It's a great song. It's a great song. It's such a great song. It makes me laugh every time, like I'm a stupid 12-year-old. And for whatever reason, Shatner was in town and called Rollins and said, hey, I'm down here at this little corner pasta shop and you have to come. You have to come. You have to come. You have to come. And so Rollins was like, I don't want to, man. It's late. And then Shatner's like, come on, this guy has some fresh clams and he's going to make fresh pasta. And so he dragged, you know, Rollins out of bed down to this pasta shop. And they apparently Shatner had this guy keep the pasta shop open all night long. And then they just basically like had fresh clams and pasta and just bullshitted all night long in this restaurant and drank wine and got crazy. And it's just one of the, and of course, this is a very abbreviated version of the story, but it really kind of, it was this, that Shatner was trying to get Henry Rollins to say, to realize, like, there's more to life than just sitting at home. And sometimes you just have to get out and be around people and experience that, because if you're not enjoying other people, you're not enjoying life. And that's kind of contrary to the Shatner image that a lot of people have, I think. And again, I'm not saying he's, you know, he's a great guy 100% of the time, because I've seen part of his reality show and I think he's very strange. But also, he's hella old, so.
Did you hear the Alton Brown cast where Shatner was on?
Yes.
At first, listening to that, I was like going to be disappointed. I mean, I was a little disappointed right at first, thinking it was going to be another Valerie Bertinelli episode. But Shatner ended up sort of turning the tables and interviewing Alton Brown.
Yeah.
Because Alton Brown came to Shatner's house and he was making homemade biscuits in Shatner's new kitchen. But Shatner just took over it and it was very, very charming. And he was trying to, like, he was actually doing a serious interview of Alton Brown that I don't think Alton Brown saw coming.
Yeah. Well, but also that was because he was thinking about, that was his launch into his own little show.
Like a cooking show or something?
That's why Shatner was doing it.
Oh,
Shatner was doing, so it was very meta. They were both doing a show.
I see. Okay. So it wasn't natural. It was all a put up job.
I think so.
I was conned. Conned.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. But it was, I thought it was terrible.
Yeah, well.
Oh, you cannot resist the puns.
I cannot. I'm powerless.
Yeah, I know. I sent you that Facebook link.
I'm going to go to the penitentiary.
I was enabling at that point. But can I just say, I really love the Alton Brown cast. I wish that he was doing them still.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you can't, you know, stick with it as a podcaster, you know. Well, then again, you know, one thing about podcasting, which, of course, we know because this is strictly amateur hour, is that there may be.
You don't make any money.
Well, there may be money to be made in podcasting, but it won't be very much. And if you're taking a ton of your own time, like for me, this is just a hobby. And you take time and Drew takes time. And so it's all time that we're taking kind of as a hobby. But if we were actually taking off time at work to do this, it would not be worth it. Like we'd have to get.
It would cost us too much.
Yeah, we'd have to get paid something. So, you know, unless, like the one thing about podcasts, why there's so many comedians who do podcasts, it's because A, comedians are entertaining so people will listen. But B, it puts butts in seats when they go and do live shows. So that's considered advertising.
Well, I think Kevin Pollak would say that when he was doing his some kind of podcasting stuff, they would talk about between podcasting and Twitter, it gives him an instant way to try out new material.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. In a very safe space. And especially now when, you know, a comedian at a club, people are already going to videotape you without your permission and put it online. So have a little bit of control of it. You know, putting it out of your own podcast, you can actually edit stuff out. Like during our 10-minute tangent, I start talking about real people. I name real business names. And I ended up going, when I edited it, I took out some stuff and then I just reversed some stuff. So I guess if you want to take it and put it through Audacity and unreverse that section, you could see what's really said. But that seems like a lot of work for anybody. That's a gigantic tangent. But I really do. I'm always happy to see William Shatner in pretty much anything he does. And as much as George Takei had sort of a feud, at least I think it was more of a one-way feud. Kind of like they say that San Francisco and LA have like a one-way feud. Like folks in San Francisco hate LA, and LA doesn't give a crap about anybody else anyway. So it's not a feud on their part.
Yeah, I don't think William Shatner has any animosity towards anybody.
Exactly.
I just think he's just like, you know, everybody's everybody.
Yeah. Hey, I'm the star of the show. So you thought I was hogging the screen? I am the screen. And this is jumping ahead, but Takei had actually really positive things to say about Shatner's direction in the next movie.
Yeah.
So shall we get back to the movie?
Yeah. We're an hour into the podcast, and I think we're maybe 20 minutes into the film.
Oh, it's okay. So Spock jumps into the tank and mind melds with the whale, much to Kirk's embarrassment. And by the way, Julian, it's a little bit of overacting, I think, or hammy acting, although not as bad as her buddy at the center.
Yeah.
Like, he was way over the top.
But, yeah, she was really over. Well, she was, I don't know if it was overacting or overwritten. She was really over. She was just absolutely overwrought, I think, and towards the end of the movie, which, you know, when she's really overreacting, I was like, I thought to myself, and I wrote down, and then I put a line through it, because I'm like, oh, I shouldn't be misogynistic like this. But I'm like, she's really Kia Messi, you know? And I hate to say that, because I'm a dude, and so, but I'm like, they really wrote this dialogue as if she's just this woman that just overreacts.
Now,
and I'm like,
I see it more like she's Bill Murray in Scrooged. She's just screaming all the time. Like,
yeah, she's kind of uppity a lot of the time.
Yeah. But then again, she's got a lot of stress in her life because they're going to send her whales away.
Well, and she starts, I mean, your first scene with her, she's all kind of like overfraught.
And we also see scenes of whales being cut up and stuff.
Yeah, I don't understand that was Nimoy's pet, by the way, pet project. I don't want to say pet. Come on. No. Nimoy did not have whales that he cut up as pets. Nimoy conceived of the plight of the whales at a dinner party with other people and thought this is what he wanted to do. He wanted to have some kind of social commentary about the whales because they were being endangered and butchered. And so he pushed for this as a plot element.
Well, he also, he and Harve Bennett, I think, also wanted the bad guy not to be like one specific bad guy.
They say that he made a point in one of the part of the features, there is no act of violence against anybody that's perpetrated by anybody. You know, if there's anything that happens, it's incidental. There's nobody who's inflicting injury on anybody else.
Which is a good point. Well, and this is a good time as any to point out that environmentalist groups were angry at this movie when it came out because of their poor treatment of whales, because they got cameras so close to the whales, much to the chagrin to find out that most of the whales were actually models, that they didn't get any close-up pictures of whales. So they were protesting the treatment of the fake whales in a swimming pool.
Not even a swimming pool. Do you know where the waterworks was filmed?
Where?
A little interesting bit of trivia. They were looking for a place to have all the water footage. And they were like, well, we could go here, we could go there. And they're like, well, I think we'll just, you know, we'll kind of do this pool in the parking lot of the studio. And then it turns out when they started excavating a little part of the parking lot, there was this bar, and they pulled the bar up, and there was a tank underneath where there had been a pool like before. And so they just tore up and reinstalled the original kind of pool area that was in the parking lot. And so almost all of the water footage was filmed on the studio parking lot.
Like in the studio grounds itself?
Yeah.
Well, and to think about it, you know, Paramount has a long history, so.
Yeah, and so he's like, you know, which they said it gave us some challenges because, of course, we had to wrap the parking lot with the background scenes, you know, so we had to have these, you know, these big long matte canvases with, you know, basically blue sky and seascape. So it gave you the illusion of the endless ocean or, you know, what have you. And they had to have little wave machines that they brought in to make heavy waves. And they brought in big giant fans that blew a mixture of smoke and water. So it like sprayed, gave kind of sea spray and all that. And he said that they, you know, the challenge was that they had to also give the actors these really thin kind of these wet suits, these dry suits to have them wear that weren't bulky underneath their clothes, except they all got sick because they all got cold because they were constantly pumping in this moist smoke that everybody was inhaling.
Well, that makes sense. It's tricky when they shoot water stuff. Eventually, yeah. Maybe, I don't know if you and I will do it or Drew and I will do it, but eventually we'll cover the movie Lifeboat, the Hitchcock movie, because I really like it. I really love it. Oh, God. Are you a fan of Lifeboat?
Okay. Is Lifeboat with the three people on the boat?
No. Many more people on the boat.
Okay. All right. I don't know that I've seen it.
Okay. Well, it's definitely worth seeing.
I don't know.
It's Tallulah Bankhead. Their lifeboat after their ship gets torpedoed by a U-boat in World War II. Okay. And they're the survivors on this big lifeboat.
Just hearing that makes me tense.
Oh, it's pretty great. It's a great little, like, it's a play kind of thing because it's very small in scope, but very rich in characters. I think Burgess Meredith is a young guy in that too. So anyway, and this is where when Jillian, I'm just going to call her Jillian, Dr. Taylor. When Jillian confronts Spock, and Kirk at first appears to be like some stranger, and
yeah, he's like taking her side and giving him the what for.
Yeah, and of course Nimoy is the best straight man ever.
All right, who the hell are you, and what were you doing in there?
Yeah, speak up, though.
Attempting the hell to communicate.
Communicate? Communicate what? You have no right to be here.
You heard the lady.
Admiral, if we were to assume that these whales are ours to do with as we please, we would be as guilty as those who caused their extinction.
Okay. I don't know what this is all about, but I want you guys out of here right now, or I call the cops.
I assure you that won't be necessary. We're only trying to help.
The hell you were, Buster. Your friend was messing up my tanks and messing up my whales.
They like you very much, but they are not the hell your whales.
I suppose they've told you that, huh?
The hell they did.
Right.
Spock.
Yes.
About those colorful metaphors that we've discussed. I don't think you should try using them anymore.
Why not?
Well, for one thing, you haven't quite got the knack of it.
I see.
And another thing, it's not always necessary to tell the truth.
I cannot tell a lie.
I don't mean lie. But you could exaggerate.
Exaggerate.
You've done it before. Can't you remember?
The hell I can't.
It's just so funny. I mean, I just think it works so well. Then we cut to Uhura and Chekhov, who are going to find the nuclear vessels. And sure enough, they found a nuclear-powered ship, the aircraft carrier Enterprise. So then we cut back to the parking lot of the Cetacean Institute, and Jillian picks up Kirk and Spock as hitchhikers. Because she has never seen any of the Ted Bundy movies or anything.
But wait a second. But Ted Bundy picked up the women.
Ah, that's true. You're right. To
in
be
his
fair.
Volkswagen Beetle.
We have to be fair to Ted Bundy.
Yeah, I'm defending her. I'm saying she's picking them up. You know, the murder isn't, you know, she. So anyway.
Yeah. Well.
I'm not defending Ted Bundy.
No, of course not.
Besides, he's dead. So.
Yes, he is. And good riddance. And I'm taking a stand here against serial killer Ted Bundy.
Way to go out on a limb for a dead serial killer.
Yeah,
really cutting edge there.
So this is now, you hopefully you know more about this than I do, but there is a scene where Sulu chats up a Huey helicopter pilot.
Yeah.
And apparently this was just a tiny little scene for continuity of a much larger scene that they cut.
Oh, see, I don't know about that.
I think there was a big action piece where Sulu steals a helicopter.
Oh, that would make sense. That would make a lot more sense than what we got. I will say that, so their plan was to fly a Huey over San Francisco, over the park, and actually have the footage of, you know, of, that you see the helicopter dropping the part into the Klingon vessel. But they couldn't really get the permits to fly a helicopter over San Francisco, and the city really wasn't going to give them a permit to fly over a park. And so they came up with this ingenious. And it really is ingenious. So there's the scene where you see the helicopter flying across the bay with the part dangling from it. That was not a full-size helicopter. That was a tiny model. And it was all forced perspective.
Oh, sweet.
So it looks convincingly real because it's like a replica scale model helicopter that one of the guys went to Japan, got the model as a kit, brought it back, put it together completely without any of the instructions because all the instructions were in Japanese. So So I had to put it completely together, and it was just this little radio control model that they used. And that was awesome because I watching it, I went back and rewatched the scene. You can't really tell that it's not a real helicopter. I mean, it's a real helicopter in as much as it's a 1/10 scale model or whatever. Because of the forced perspective, it's still the skyline. They still use San Francisco skyline. Of course they could, because it was a toy.
Yeah, it's great. That's the magic of movie making.
Yeah, it's kind of genius when you think about it.
Oh, yeah. Then we have a scene where Scotty and Bones trade the formula of transparent aluminum for the materials they needed for the whale tank.
And I wrote something here. I wrote, Newman's brother is managing the Plexicorp plant.
Oh, totally. Yeah, the Plexicorp plant is hilarious. And I love. There's lots of geekery around the computer scene.
Yeah. But so I have a question, though.
Yes.
Why did it have to be transparent aluminum? Why is this a plot point? Why is this important? I don't understand.
Because all they really are making is really super dense, strong plexiglass.
Yeah, but who cares? Why? Why did it have to be transparent?
It didn't have to be transparent. I don't know why they had to be transparent.
I know. It was just one of those things that it doesn't have to be transparent. No one cares. The whales don't care. You're not going to care.
Yeah, because it's just going to confuse the whales further being transparent. Because not like they're in a bubble. They're still inside, fully inside the Klingon ship. Yeah, it makes no sense why it's transparent. But the scene where Scotty talks into the mouse is admittedly pretty funny.
Hello, computer.
And, of course, all the graphics are actually like IBM or HP graphics. But HP or IBM wouldn't give them, they wanted them to buy the computer. And Apple said, no, use one of ours. So Apple donated the computer itself. So that's why it's an Apple computer that they're using.
It's like a Macintosh classic.
Yeah.
With the funny giant mouse button.
Yep. Hey, the first mouse ever. Let's shoot, the first personal computer for all intents and purposes. For all intents and purposes. For all of our purposes. French benefits. Anyway, so as after the scene with Scotty typing very insistently and trading the material, then we get Jillian and Kirk going to the Italian restaurant to eat. Well...
Okay, and I have to say, who sells Michelob on tap?
Well, it was the 80s.
I know, but God, and who orders Michelob on tap? Like, that's got to be product placement.
Oh, yeah, it has to be. Actually, before they even get to the restaurant, they drop Spock off at the park where he's going to hang out, and it's already explained that Spock took too much LDS in the 60s. That's why he's so weird.
Yeah.
And that's a funny little scene. So, yeah, so they go and they have their Michelobes, which apparently does not compare favorably to Romulan ale.
No, because Kirk makes funny faces at it.
He
repeatedly
makes skunk face, right?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it's totally skunk face. You're right.
So anyway, so he chats her up and asks for the tracking frequency for the whales, but she refuses. He explains pretty much as he can. And, she doesn't believe him, but she likes the way he looks, and or she's warm for his form or whatever, because she's letting herself be chatted up. And at this point, Uhura and Chekov beam aboard the Enterprise, the USS Enterprise ship, to collect the power they need. And unfortunately, they are discovered aboard after Uhura beams back, but Chekov is captured. And this is a funny scene.
Chekov, can you hear me? Scotty, now would be a good time. Chekov! I've lost him.
Commander Pavel Chekov, Starfleet, United Federation of Planets. All right, Commander. Is there anything you want to tell us?
Like what?
Like who you really are and what you're doing here and what these things here are.
I am Pavel Chekov, a commander in Starfleet, United Federation of Planets. Service number 656-5827D.
All right. Let's take it from the top.
The top of what?
Name.
My name?
No, my name.
I do not know your name.
You play games with me, mister, and you're through.
I am? May I go now?
What do you think?
He's a Ruski.
That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in my life. Of course he's a Rusky, but he's a retard or something.
We better call Washington.
Don't move.
Okay, make nice. Give us the ray gun.
I warn you, if you don't lie on the floor, I will have to stun you.
Go ahead. Stun me.
I'm very sorry, but... Must be the radiation.
You know, this movie works in the time it was made, but again, this goes back to one of those, it's the Cold War. You know, like if you know, when your daughter watches this movie as an adult, if she ever does, it's not going to make as much sense.
Oh, if Putin keeps up, it might make sense.
Well, that's good. That's true.
Yeah, there's a narrow window maybe that where the Russians were the good guys, except, of course, for the mafia. Again, this is before Blackhawks. This is back, still they have Huey helicopters. So this is still post-Vietnam Cold War sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, so unfortunately, though, Chekhov tries to make an escape, but he is severely injured.
And when they were filming the scene, because he's like, first when they're down in the quote-unquote reactor area, which is BS, by the way, but, you know, he's like, the guy is like, points the gun at his head. And he was a real actual, he was a real naval officer. Like, and so, you know, Walter Koenig was kind of like, it was a little frightening because, you know, the guy was very, very, very serious into his job. But then he goes, and then as I'm running across the deck, I realized, like, I don't know, I'm hoping all of that's fake guns, but I'm aboard a naval ship. I don't know that it's all fake. And so he goes, I was just trying to outrun them as much as I could for real.
That makes sense. And yeah, he gets actually seriously injured when he falls off the one deck to the other. Well, this, though, the Sulu helicopter is the materials of the bounty. And then Jillian does some mimery in the park until Kirk reluctantly beams her aboard the bounty. And, you know, there's some funny stuff there. But then Jillian, Kirk, and McCoy have to go to the hospital, dress as physicians to rescue Chekhov. Now, the music, which I will put in here, and the scene, which Weird have already kind of lined up for you, reminded me completely of 9 to 5.
How's the patient, doctor?
He's going to make it.
He came in with a sheet.
One little mistake.
They've taken the patient. Get some help.
Hold it! Hold it!
Stop, stop, stop.
Fully functional.
It's the 9 to 5 scene.
I was gonna say the same thing.
I mean, yeah, except for the fact that Kirk doesn't tell someone to piss off. It's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
In fact, I thought I was trying to look up the surgeon's name because I thought it was Frank Oz at first.
He did kind of have that. Yeah, you're right. He did kind of have that. I don't know what that.
The Miss Piggy kind of voice.
Yeah, that kind of, I was going to say frog in your throat voice.
No, that would be his buddy.
No, that would be Miss Piggy.
Oh, that's true, frog in your throat. Oh, that's, okay, sorry, I didn't realize you were going for a blowjob joke there.
Yeah, well.
Good times. So, they now return, after this little shenanigans, they return to the Bird of Prey, which is fully recharged. So Kirk is going to beam aboard and says goodbye to Jillian. And she's like, no, she's not taking anything, no for an answer. So as Kirk is getting beamed aboard, she just jumps on him. She has not seen the horrible things that happen with transporter accidents.
Yeah, this is true.
Because that's the first thing I thought is, oh, if they're expecting one and all of a sudden she jumps on there, there could be horrible repercussions. Luckily, though, it works out just fine. And then we discover that it's no wonder that the humpback whales are being hunted to extinction. I don't even know if I mentioned before that the reason Jillian comes back to the park is because they released her whales early. But they have to go rescue the whales before a whaling ship gets to them. Like, the whale ships are freaking Johnny on the spot.
I know. In Alaska, by the way.
Also, they're not Japanese. Explain
no, they're like,
that.
They're Dutch or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird. Weird, like Slavic. It's like, maybe, but you know what? Those are Japanese whale hunters in Alaska waters.
Yeah. And again, there it was Alaska waters. I'm like, what kind of weird conflict? Who? Like, there was not a lot of research going on.
Yeah. Well, that's okay. They saved it all for a transparent aluminum. Which, by the way, apparently, for my trivia, was invented in 2009.
Was it really?
Yes. So I don't even know what that means or why it's useful, but oh well.
Now I have to look it up.
Yeah. So anyway.
I have a picture of it.
Oh, do you? And does it have properties of aluminum?
It's real glass-like see-through metal.
Huh. Well, why don't we have transparent aluminum on the iPhone then?
It's probably hella expensive.
Well, okay, there's that.
And aluminum is a soft metal, so I imagine that it probably bends and dents.
Scratches maybe.
You know, enough problems with the iPhone's bending, they probably, you know.
You wouldn't be so worried about it bending if you wouldn't break your glass, right? I mean, isn't that the point of the problem with the bending?
For now, it is used in static-free transparent aluminum wrapping for computer parts and other electronics. It's also being tested in otherwise conventional see-through soda cans and military shielding for vehicles where windows once were. At over $10 per square inch, however, it's still not cheap enough for mainstream everyday use, but maybe someday.
Wow. Well, see? And Scotty gave the Polycorp, whatever it was called.
Plexicorp. Newman's brother.
Yeah, let your fingers do the walking.
Yeah. Yeah, another anachronism.
Oh, well, exactly. And also another product placement. Like yeah. Pacific Bell. Oh, that's another anachronism, too. A Bell company? Huh.
Yeah, I know.
So.
What's a phone book?
I know. You'll never find a payphone these days. So, after transporting the whales aboard the ship, the crew returns with Taylor to their own time. This is actually breaking the Prime Directive, right?
Yeah, taking her back with them.
Yeah. Well, maybe not. Well, actually, giving them stealing the whales and giving them the formula for... also, by the way, they also cut a Sulu scene where Sulu meets his grandfather or his great-grandfather.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I want to say that the little boy out in front of the shop where the Pacific Bell saw a big, gigantic, let your fingers to the walking yellow pages.
Oh,
Pacific Bell.
God, with his family?
I think that was supposed to be his family.
Oh, that would be odd. That's genius.
Yeah, well, again.
Huh.
Yeah, so.
That makes more sense as to why that scene existed, though.
True. Yeah, you're right, because there's no other reason for it except for the big sign.
Well, except I think it was supposed to call attention. Scotty and McCoy are supposed to call attention to the building, so they're like, that's how we could find it.
Well, exactly, yeah. The fact that these characters come out in the middle of it. No, they were there. He was there. It was just after Kirk and Spock were off getting the $100.
So, and not to be a buzzkill so they beam up the whales, right, into the tank?
Yes.
So what is at the beginning of the movie, chatty Dr. Jillian talks about the property of whales being mammals. And do you remember what one of the things about mammals and whales are?
That they need to breathe air?
Yeah. So you just beam the tank full of water into this area. So how do you suppose the whales are going to get up and breathe?
Well, they don't have to breathe very long, remember? They're going to Okay, I have another thing. Okay, remember... go ahead.
Time warp time. I mean, it wasn't instantaneous. I mean, for the sake of the movie and the brevity, but the actual time warp took several minutes.
That's true.
So anyway, it was just one of those things where I'm like, all right, you made a big point about being like, oh, all these things, but then you didn't follow your own rules. You should have at least left, like, I don't know, a third of the tank without water so you could see the water sloshing around. I guess maybe that wasn't dramatic enough or something. I don't know. But I'm sure there'll be some angry geek somewhere that knows the answer, but, you know, he's not listening to our podcast.
Okay, well, how about this one, though? Remember in the first movie, the Enterprise, they were worried about going warp speed while still in the solar system?
Yeah.
They're going into warp speed while still in Earth's atmosphere. They could have ripped the entire atmosphere with them off into space, killed the entire planet, at least of humans, theoretically, of course.
Well, they've learned a lot since then. They've learned how to manage things.
They have, yes. So, anyway, they arrive, and they crash land in San Francisco Bay, and there's a nice little scene where Kirk has to save the day by swimming.
And those are all William Shatner.
I'm sure, yeah. And he has a good hairpiece on.
Yeah, very much so. It's not the same thing. I'm like, wow, they paid a lot for that hairpiece because it stayed put.
Oh, yeah. It looked great. It even parted when he was swimming. Awesome. So the whales give out their mysterious response to the signal, and the probe then goes away. Problem solved. Never knew or cared about what the signal was. Like, the whales, you think, would be quite confused. But, oh well.
Well, except Spock told them what the plan was, and that, you know, he said they seemed to agree with the plan.
Oh, there you go. Okay. That makes sense.
So early on when he did the mind meld, which who knew he could mind meld with pets and animals? So, apparently, you know, he told them what they wanted to do and they, you know, why they were doing it, and they seemed agreeable to doing it.
Trivia. The whale was the second largest thing he ever mind melded with. The first, of course, being the V'ger. They are brought.
It's the largest thing in this body.
Yeah. Well, okay. Two things. Okay.
Spock version 2.0.
Here we're going to do one little more piece of nitpickery, and that is this. Okay. As impressive as those big stabilizer things were to keep the what they must have been, transparent aluminum panels, but I think looked a lot more like glass. Wouldn't you think if they just invested in some damn plywood?
Well, where are you going to get plywood at that time of night?
Come on. It's Starfleet. There's got to be a crew. Just like there's kitchens, or at least people who repair the...
If you want to get really nitpicky, you know, they have tractor beams and force fields, too.
Well, yeah,
so granted,
exactly.
They were having energy problems, but like you could have replicated something really quick too.
Or they could have used plywood. Yeah.
All right. I mean, yeah.
Because instead of standing people in front of a big sheet of glass, you don't do that. Don't stand people in front of glass.
Also, they only propped up one of the three windows.
Well, of course. Yeah. They don't have very many of those things.
If one of them was starting to fail, wouldn't you prop all three of them up?
Yeah.
I mean, wouldn't it stand to reason?
Or maybe even have, you know what? I think they, even back in 1986, they had rolling shutter technology. Where they just close the shutters.
To be fair, I mean, that would never occur to them because something like that would never happen if they're, you know.
Politics, that's what it was. They should have spent more time and money on preparedness than on writing crops for the captain of the fucking Excelsior.
Well. I'm guessing that. my composure. I'm guessing there's no FEMA in the future.
I guess not. Hell of a job, Brownie. So we end up with the nice scene again, a nice closing scene where all of the crew of the Bounty are summoned before Starfleet to be punished for their crimes. And Spock joins them, even though he's not accused, but he stands with the crew. And this is where he could have said, I'm standing with my damn crew. But that would have been one joke too many. So it's a very solemn scene. And It turns out, even though they pled guilty to all sorts of stuff, everything was dropped because they saved the Earth, which is, you know, relatively speaking, that is a mitigating circumstance. So nobody gets punished except Kirk, and Kirk is then demoted to the rank of captain. Where then he departs on their ship, the newly christened USS Enterprise, NC 1701A. And they go on a new mission.
Don't get me started. It should technically be the B, by the way.
You'd think. Yeah.
Nitpicky.
Well.
So, the end of the trilogy.
And a very satisfying, fun movie. Everybody was funny, and there was enough comic book peril that it gave it a little bit of tension, but not too much. It was more a fish out of water, kind of. It was more Beverly Hills Cop, really.
And Nimoy made a big point that he wanted lots of sound effects, but when the probe was present on the screen, he didn't really want any dramatic music. And so a lot of this movie doesn't have dramatic music accompaniment.
But
there's
what
some,
it does,
not a lot.
It is galloping, though, when it happens.
So, yeah. And so, interesting trivia on the probe noise.
I'm anxious to hear about probe noise. Speak slowly.
So the sound guy and so there was an interview with the sound guy, and he said, you know, Nimoy and Harv kept coming back to him and saying, this isn't the right sound for the probe. So give us something else. And so he would go back and he's like, I'm convinced this is the noise you want. And Nimoy would be like, no, you still don't have it. Come back when you get it. And so I guess he said on like the 19th time he brought it to Nimoy, and Nimoy was like, no, you still don't have it. And he was like, okay, here's a microphone. Tell me what it should sound like. And so Nimoy goes up on the microphone. And he goes, it should sound like this. Wub, 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 wub. And that's the noise he used. He took Nimoy's voice, scrubbed it, and that's what you got. And so Derek and I are just laughing because he's like, the sound guy was like, that's what I get for being a cocky prick. You know, I was like, well, Mr. Nimoy, you tell me how it should sound like. And he's like, I gave him exactly the sound he wanted.
There you go.
So, and when you go back and listen to it, if you go back and listen to it, you will totally hear it now.
That's funny.
Mr. President.
It's hilarious. It's like it was the first dubstep ever.
Well, I love the fact that it's like, okay, let's take this noise and let's put it underwater. Like, oh yeah, they've got that capability, but they don't have a way to shutter the windows during case of a storm. Yeah, let's get the salinity content of the water right. It's like, what? Oh well. Yeah, so all in all, this was a fun movie. Is it the best, technically, of the four movies we've watched? No, probably not. But is it the most fun? I think so. I think
it's got a lot of fun going for it, for sure.
And definitely, there's nobody that outshines the crew, which is nice. Because in the first movie, Stephen Collins totally stole the show.
Yeah.
And in the second movie, you had basically, Kirk versus Khan. And then you had, of course, Nimoy and Bones being the more dramatic things. And in the third movie, you had some David going on, and you had Savick. But in this movie, it was pretty much just the core crew members. And I had heard a podcast where it talks about how at the very end, when Savick and Spock have the conversation, and Savick basically says, you know, that he accepts Spock as his half-human or whatever, and they suggested that it was like Spock was coming out of the closet.
I can see that.
Like, I thought it was a little reaching, but also, you know, I mean, really, there has been tension between Savick, not Savick, who am I thinking of? Sarek and Spock. But other than that, it's pretty much straightforward, just fun. So next week, we're off to 5, which is widely considered to be the worst of the 6 movies we'll be watching.
Oh, it is the worst of the 6 movies.
So I can't wait. I'm going to come into it with an open heart. And
me too. I mean, I'll watch it. I mean, like, you know, I haven't seen it in, it's been some time. It's probably been at least 15 years. Because every time I go through it, I just skip this one and just skip 5.
For me, I'm sure it was the one I saw in the theater. I can't imagine seeing it since.
I don't think I saw it in the theater. I know that I saw it when I was working as music market manager, and know that it was playing in Home Electronics recursively because it was on a laser disc that they had.
Anyway.
A laser disc.
Send your feedback to show@notinthecreepyway.com or call us on a new voicemail account to leave voice messages, or you can text us at this account to leave text messages. The number is 425-243-9169. That's 425-243-9169. What are you waiting for? Put it in your phone right now, and then when you listen to an episode, you can just hit your contacts, dial it already.